Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back my guest co-host, Dr. Leah Ranney, Associate Director at the University of North Carolina's Tobacco Prevention Evaluation Program. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Ranney.
Thanks for having me.
You know, on our show today, we get to have an exciting interview with Dr. Jonathan Oberlander, Professor and Chair of Social Medicine at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, talking about everything that listeners may be interested in knowing about healthcare and upcoming elections. I know I'm interested to hear his thoughts about where we come together and where we depart.
It's going to be an exciting November, so it'll be interesting to hear that interview.
But first, we've got some interesting research that matters, and let's jump right in. And their very first research that matters is about electrical brain stimulation during sleep and memory. Do you want to volunteer for this study?
Well, I'm a big proponent in thinking that sleep is the best thing. I know I enjoy sleep, and this is a great time for your brain to heal, your body to heal, and your brain to be active. And this is a very interesting study about how this electrical brain stimulation during your sleep is boosting memory for people who have memory issues, such as Alzheimer's.
Yeah, this was some really, I agree, interesting research. It was in a journal called Current Biology. It's actually research done by the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, some of our colleagues, yay. And they were looking at the use of what's called transcranial alternating current stimulation, a type of electrical stimulation of the brain to target a specific type of brain activity during sleep, which they think could strengthen memory. Now, in this particular case, they were doing it in healthy people, but you're absolutely right. The question of can this actually work in people who have memory disorders? And I find this really interesting because, as you say, there's a restorative component. We know that when we sleep, we can wake up feeling refreshed. How do you think it would work to go to bed at night and to wake up with a stronger memory than when you went to bed?
That would be great.
It would be great. And in this particular study, one of the things they tried to do is they took these participants and they had them have two nights of sleep for the study, and they had them do two common memory exercises. One was word pairing test. I say tomato, you say vegetable, or I say treadmill, and you say
run.
Run, yes. And then there was these motor sequencing tapping things, you know, repeatedly tapping the fingers like I'm tapping the microphone. So we do these things to try to see that may be stored in memory. And then they had them have one time where they got this alternating current electrical activity one night. And then the other night, they was like a sham stimulation. It wasn't real alternating current stimulation. And what did they find?
Well, they found that these spindles are very crucial to memory. And with the stimulation, memory improved.
Yeah. There wasn't as much improvement in the associated word painting, but it was a significant improvement in the motor task. And so the question really becomes, could this work in people who do have memory disorders like Alzheimer's or schizophrenia or other things that really cause people difficulty in new memory formation? I think this is very exciting research. I hope our listeners pay attention, perhaps more funding in this type of research. Not yet ready for prime time, but hopefully in the distant future. Speaking of prime time, this next research, really interesting. I'd be curious what you think about it, Leah. It's about Instagram feeds and social media and depression. First off, do you have an Instagram account?
I'm embarrassed to say no, I do not.
I don't either, though I really have thought about it recently. And they're not talking about us, really, because they're talking about people who have Instagram accounts, but they are talking about social media. And what does it say about the colors that you use on your social media and the pictures you put on and perhaps mood? What are they looking at?
Well, they were looking at the brightness of the colors and intensity of the colors and also how people selected faces or not faces to see if there's a differential between people who were depressed and not depressed.
Right. So those who have lower saturation, decreased brightness, that there is a much more concern that this may be related to depression. And I guess there seems to find some relationship here. And it's like if you think that someone might be depressed by looking at some of their Instagram, I might even say Facebook pictures, that's maybe based in some reality. That seems kind of intuitive, but I think that suggests that we might be able to talk with people when we see things and reach out. I don't know what your thoughts are.
Well, I think it'd be interesting to reach out, talk to people if you knew them personally. I think it would be hard to implement something like this in the medical setting.
Yeah, I think it's more like in our own social network setting. But talk about this next research that matters and implementing in a medical setting. This is as exciting as research as I've come across in a long time, though I will say it's exceedingly early, but it's really potentially hopeful. And that's about virtual brain training and helping paralyzed people regain some movement. And when I first saw this, I said, really? Really? But I say, really. Tell us a little bit about this, Leah.
Well, it was really fascinating that they had a group of people who had no movement below their waist. I believe they were paralyzed. But they actually started off on the baseline doing brain imaging to find out if they had any kind of cognitive activity when they asked these participants to imagine walking. And there was no brain activity for walking. And then when they started the study, they actually did the brain training. And that is do many imaging of walking, and they found that that helped retrain the brain of these patients.
Right. This is virtual reality with walking simulations designed for feedback, tactile feedback with ever things that the person could sense and kind of the movement of the legs. And it seemed to kind of reawaken areas that still had some function but were completely unused. And these people regained some function, whether they could have some movement, some ability to control bladder again, people who had not had this. And this was very early. This was actually done by one of our sister institutions. It was called the Duke's Walk Again Project, published in the journal Scientific Reports. I think this is potentially a groundbreaking research that matters. I'm very excited.
Me too. After 1 year of training, half of these patients had to be reclassified as partial paralegics, which is absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
Great news.
Yeah. And our last piece of research that matters is not so great news. I feel like we're kind of going back and forth between things that make us feel hopeful. And this is something that we should just be aware of and we want to bring to attention, which is research on disparities. We talk about disparities in healthcare, the difference between what sometimes people who perhaps are more privileged, higher income, get care, and those who are less privileged. In this particular case, it's the difference perhaps in diagnosis and treatment of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder in white versus non-white children. What do we know here, Leah?
Well, like several other issues with disparities, we are finding that there is underdiagnosis of ADHD and treatment for non-white kids as opposed to white parents. And some of this is just finding that white parents are more likely to go to the physician and request this type of push for treatment.
And in many cases, that could be medication. This was in the journal Pediatrics. And I think it suggests that there is a disparity here, as there is in many aspects of medicine, that's worthy for doctors to think about, clinicians to think about, and also parents. If you're the parent of a non-white kid, be aware that the doctor may have some less awareness, maybe less willingness to talk about it. There's lots of different reasons here. I think it's to be an advocate for your kid at any age here, and let's help close this disparity. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Jonathan Oberlander, professor and chair of social medicine at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, about healthcare and health policy issues voters need to know about in upcoming elections. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Leah Ranney. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Leah Ranney. Today on Conversations, Leah, we're talking with Dr. Jonathan Oberlander, professor and chair of social medicine at the University of North Carolina's School of Medicine and professor of health policy and management at the University of North Carolina's Gilling School of Public Health, about the healthcare and health policy landscape that voters should know about in upcoming elections. And welcome to Your Health, Dr. Oberlander.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, we were talking beforehand. Your voice is such an important voice in the national landscape and the perspective articles that you write and publicize in the New England Journal of Medicine about health policy. So first off, thank you on behalf of the American public for lending a voice to help describe important issues. Help us understand how you got really interested in what I call health policy and social medicine. What got you really interested in this particular field of public health?
Well, it actually started when I was an undergraduate here at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And in my sophomore year, I went to Hebrew University in Jerusalem to study Middle Eastern politics and foreign policy. And during my time there, I was busy demonstrating the superiority of North Carolina basketball out on the courts in Jerusalem. And I blew out my anterior cruciate ligament, which you can tell the listeners what a pleasant experience that is. And that led to a rather lengthy and convoluted time in the Israeli healthcare system, which was very different from the U.S. healthcare system. This was back in the mid to late 80s. When I came back to Carolina as a junior in the fall of 1987, I wanted to take a class on the Soviet Union, which, to date myself, existed. And not only did it exist, but the class that was on the Soviet politics, which was taught by Joel Schwartz, one of the more renowned professors in the UNC Department of Political Science, was fully subscribed. This was back in the days when you had those little cards to register for classes. So I couldn't get in Joel's class on the Soviet Union, but he was teaching another class on comparative healthcare systems. I thought that was the most boring topic I had heard of in my life, but I did have in the back of my mind these experiences I had in the Israeli healthcare system. So I ended up, long story short, enrolling in Joel's class at the time, Poly 132, and that changed my academic life, and I then went on to graduate school to study healthcare politics.
Well, that's wonderful. I know I've known Joel for a long time, and I know his influence on generations of students. And
absolutely.
That is a great story.
Yes, it is. This is really great and timely topic as we roll into the elections and having Obamacare as one of the major issues between our candidates. I'd be interested to hear your perspective about Obamacare and what the candidates have suggested as solutions or changes.
Yeah, so Obamacare is everywhere, and it's sort of hard to, I think, separate out the perception from the reality. The reality of Obamacare, I would say, is mixed. On the one hand, there are real substantial achievements in North Carolina, in the country as a whole. The uninsured rate in the United States has fallen almost in half in the last 6 years since the law was passed. We've gone from having about 48.5 million persons in the United States without health insurance to around 27 million without health insurance. And that, given everything that's gone wrong with the law and all the resistance to it, that is a remarkable accomplishment. Millions of Americans have more health security today, more access to medical care than they did before the Affordable Care Act was passed. On the other hand, it is a law that, while it has substantial achievements, it also has significant shortcomings, not the least of which is we still have 27 million people without health insurance. And while the law has reduced the number of Americans without health insurance, those who are uninsured, it's also clear that it is not addressing fully the problems that we have with underinsurance. And here we don't talk about this nearly enough, and folks who are out there will understand this very well, which is that if you have health insurance, it doesn't mean you have good insurance, good coverage. There are a lot of Americans who have health insurance who have very high deductibles. They're subject to very high co-payments and co-insurance, and they're one illness from discovering that their coverage is inadequate. And we know that the percentage of Americans paying high deductibles for their health insurance continues to go higher and higher. So that issue of underinsurance, I think, is one that is very substantial. Another problem that really the Affordable Care Act has not solved is we still have about a quarter of poor Americans who don't have any health insurance at all. And while the law has been very successful at signing up those who have very, very low incomes for health insurance, and in the states that have expanded Medicaid, unlike North Carolina, signing up folks who are eligible for Medicaid, for people whose incomes are modest, who maybe make $18,000 $20,000, $25,000. A lot of those folks are eligible for help, and yet they're not signed up for the law.
So it seems as if those who are opposed to, angry with, unsatisfied, however we want to describe with Obamacare, are louder than those who feel that it's benefited them. Is that the case? And if it is, what implications does that have? How does the political dynamic influence the reality of what happens to implementation in the future of these acts?
Yeah, it's a great question. And we know that the country is divided. If you look at the public opinion polls, several election cycles later, millions of dollars of advertising spent. The public opinion on Obamacare is virtually identical in 2016 to what it was in 2010. Hmm. And that is a country that is divided on the law, but where more people have an unfavorable view of the law than favorable. And there has been some opinion polling in the past showing that exactly what you're saying, that there were folks who are negative about the law that they feel that more passionately than folks who are in favor of the law. So there is a little bit of an asymmetry there. And it does affect the politics of this. This is not Medicare. It's not Social Security. It's not that popular. As a result, the law, I think, is more politically vulnerable and remains more vulnerable going into this 2016 election than other programs that we're used to. The other point that I think is really important that you make is the partisan polarization in this country. The distance ideologically between Democrats and Republicans in Congress is further than at any point since the 1870s. And after all, we had just fought the Civil War. So we live in an era of great polarization in our politics. And if you think about the Affordable Care Act, it is modeled after what was done in Massachusetts with Governor Romney, a Republican. It in many ways has Republican elements to the law, but the reaction to it has been polarized at the federal level, at the state level. There has been tremendous resistance to implementing the law in many states. And so I think that partisan polarization has shaped it, and it's made fixing it more difficult. There are fixes that you can imagine that Democrats and Republicans in a normal political era would agree, let's change this. But every fight about the Affordable Care Act is an existential fight about its very existence.
It's between good and evil.
Exactly. And so that makes compromise. You can't compromise when you're fighting between good and evil. And that has made incremental changes to the law very hard to come by.
Well, that comes to what my question was. Is there one or two things that could be modified or changed with Obamacare that would probably relax this strain that we have between the Republican and Democrat candidates, that people could be a little bit more satisfied with Obamacare than they are right now? I mean, you brought out the point about the uninsured, and that happens to a good group of people in the United States who don't meet that cutoff for the low income, but yet are making a lot of money, and they're completely underinsured, but they're paying thousands of dollars to have almost barely any health care be insured at all. That, I think, is why this Obamacare is losing a lot of traction with people of the middle income.
Yeah, there's no question that people in the middle are being squeezed. They're paying those higher deductibles. Now, there is a gap between Obamacare's performance and perception of it. And anything that goes wrong in U.S. healthcare, people tend to attribute to Obamacare. It's a syndrome. I don't know if we could get this recognized, but I call it Obamacare-itis. And likewise, advocates of Obamacare tend to claim everything positive for the law. And the truth is a lot more complicated. The shift in American health insurance, the thinning out of American health insurance, where it is not comprehensive as it used to be, where more people are paying more out of their pockets and people in the middle are being squeezed, that was ongoing before the law was passed. However, the law has not reversed it. It's also the case that if we look at healthcare spending in the United States, we are a very expensive system, the most expensive in the world by a lot. But if you look at spending growth since 2009, it actually is very, very moderate. And this is an unacknowledged success of the law. People generally don't know this, that our spending as a country has gone up at historically low levels the last 5 or 6 years, which is a good thing. It makes Medicare more affordable, Medicaid more affordable, employer-sponsored coverage more affordable. Trying to change public opinion on the law, as you're suggesting, is really, really difficult. People's views are set. Partly those views are based on real things, real shortcomings that Obamacare absolutely has. Part of it is based on things that don't exist in the law. people still believing that there are, for example, death panels. Last time I looked, about a third of Americans believe that the Affordable Care Act created death panels. Not true.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break. But when we return, I think we want to pick up on what is likely to happen under different scenarios here, and maybe we can learn and return to some international examples and find out what stays, what changes. But we're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. Jonathan Oberlander, professor and chair of social medicine at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, about health care and health policy issues voters need to know about before November. You're listening to Your Health. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Leah Ranney. We've been talking with Dr. Jonathan Oberlander, professor and chair of social medicine at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, about healthcare and health policy issues, things that maybe voters can consider before November. But Dr. Oberlander, let's just dive right in, and let's just say we're now in February of 2017, and we're going to give you two different scenarios. Let's take the first scenario, and let's say perhaps the Democrats have won the White House and perhaps a sweep with taking one of the houses and some change in governorships. What happens with Obamacare?
Well, I think under that circumstance, you will see the Democrats try and build on Obamacare. Hillary Clinton has embraced it, and I think their agenda would be largely an incremental one. They'll have several challenges. One would be to shore up these health insurance marketplaces, these online portals where the uninsured under Obamacare can go and buy coverage. Your listeners will be familiar perhaps with healthcare.gov, the federal website that's run in most of the states. And those health insurance exchanges have had some turbulence. United Health has pulled out of many of them. The same with Aetna, same with Humana. There is going to be a need to stabilize insurer participation in those health insurance exchanges, and you could conceive of a sort of package of measures that would do that. I think a Clinton administration, if Hillary Clinton wins the presidency, will work on that affordability issue that we were talking about. She has proposed tax credits, for example, to help people pay out-of-pocket costs, their deductibles, probably work on that. If you want to sort of dream bigger, what Democrats might do, another thing they might do would be to try and open Medicare up. There's been a lot of talk in the Democratic Party about expanding Medicare eligibility. It's 65 and older now. Why don't we bring it down to 55 and give people a chance to buy into the Medicare program as a sort of the ultimate public option? That's something that'd be very hard to get through Congress, but I think you'd see some talk about it.
So let's see the flip side of that with Donald Trump actually winning the presidency in November and then the House and the Senate, the composition relatively staying the same. How do you see Obamacare shaping up after that?
It's really hard to predict what Donald Trump will do as president, and not just on health care. Health care has not really been a prominent topic for him, much more on immigration, much more on ISIS. He has a health care plan, but it's small. He hasn't said that much about it. So we really don't know. In the past, he's been a supporter of single payer. He said nice things about the Canadian system, about the British system, where he stands on health care. It's not exactly clear. There's no question that if he wins the presidency and Republicans hold majorities in the House and Senate, there will be an effort to repeal Obamacare. Could they repeal the entire law? Would they? Probably not. Could they repeal major parts of the law? Absolutely. Yes, they could. And they would have to decide what kind of political roll the dice they want to take going down that path. And then the question is, what would they replace Obamacare with? And I think the question about how Donald Trump would work with Paul Ryan and other Republicans in Congress is really an open one.
I think this kind of raises a fundamental question, which is there has to be things that we all agree on needs reform. It seems like no one, with perhaps the exception of Bernie Sanders, was saying we should go immediately to a single-payer system in the United States. Yet, coming back to your example of Israel and the healthcare, you were exposed at a young age to a country that was one of the first to really become more of a single-payer type system. We have Canada to the north. But we don't think we're going to be going down that path anytime soon in the United States. Am I right about that?
You're right. Single payer continues to have very strong support, particularly on the left of the Democratic Party. But politically, it's hard to see a path in the short term for it.
So if there was agreement, what would we would agree on?
Well, the problem is the things that we would think there would be agreement on is what the Affordable Care Act has, namely expanding health insurance through private insurers, regulating private insurers, and creating these insurance pools with an individual mandate. Those were all ideas in the past that had bipartisanship to them. That bipartisan sheen has worn off as a result of that polarized politics. So now the question is, what could Democrats and Republicans agree to on the Affordable Care Act? And there might be some things. For example, they might agree to repeal the so-called Cadillac tax, a tax on high-cost private insurance plans that health economists love and regular people hate. That could go. They might agree to either redo or eliminate the penalty on employers who don't offer, or larger employers who don't offer coverage under the Affordable Care Act. Republicans have always opposed it. Democrats don't love the way it exists in the Affordable Care Act. It's sort of Byzantine. You might In this nirvana of bipartisanship that we're imagining, you might actually see some agreement on how to stabilize those health insurance exchanges. And so, in theory, lots of those things could happen. Will they happen? We'll see.
And then, what's happening internationally? If we look at the landscape of some of the industrial countries, most of whom have some sort of version of a single payer system, what do we learn from their experience that actually may be informative to election cycles in the United States and political influence?
The American system is unique, and it's uniquely bad in certain ways. I mean, we have wonderful physicians and nurses and health professionals. We have terrific health technology. We're very innovative. But the organization of our system is remarkable in its inefficiency and its inequity. We're the most expensive system in the world. Much of what we spend on medical care, and you all know this, is not for medical care. It's for paperwork. It's those explanation of benefits that I get when I go to the doctor and that doctor's offices have to fill out. So much of what we're spending is not in medical care, isn't for care. It's just for administrative costs. We are the only rich democracy with a substantial portion of the population that doesn't have any health insurance at all. So I think what international experience, Canada, Germany, Japan, the Netherlands, those sorts of countries teach us is it is possible to have a system that's universal. It's possible to have a universal system that controls healthcare spending much better than we do in the United States. None of those countries is perfect. All those systems have problems, but the problems in the United States are on a whole different level.
So where would you recommend our listeners go to educate themselves on pertinent issues about healthcare, on Obamacare, or the issues that are going on in our presidential debates?
I'm a big fan of the Kaiser Family Foundation. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan group. Their URL, if you want to look them up on the web, is www.kff.org. And they put out easy to understand information that explains what the Affordable Care Act does, different trends. If you want to follow it sort of to a different level, you could look at their daily report on the Kaiser Health News that tracks stories from all over the country because Obamacare is playing out differently in very different states. But I think the Kaiser Family Foundation really is a good place to start.
And we'll have our great health science librarians put a link up on our site for that. If you could leave our listeners with one final thought, what would it be?
I would end on an optimistic note. There are a lot of problems with American politics. We've learned that much. There are a lot of remaining challenges in the healthcare system and a lot of very real problems with Obamacare. And yet, I think in these last few years, we've made substantial strides to reduce the uninsured rate the way we have. We are in a healthcare system that is more equitable, that is more fair than it was in 2010. So I am optimistic about the future.
Well, we appreciate the optimism. We appreciate this thought of this nirvana world of perhaps some bipartisanship. And appreciate your time today for Your Health listeners.
Thanks so much for doing this and having me on.
We've been talking with Dr. Jonathan Oberlander, professor and chair of social medicine at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, professor of health policy and management at the University of North Carolina Gilling School of Public Health, about healthcare and health policy issues in the coming elections. Coming up on House Calls, we're going to be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Leah Ranney. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Leah and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And Leah, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call today about a listener who's having some depression and anxiety. Laura?
I've been feeling more depressed and anxious recently after some life-changing events, and I think I might want to start seeing a therapist. How do I go about starting the therapy process?
You are not alone. I'm sorry to hear about life-changing events, and I think really, you know, no one is immune to stresses in life and loss and trauma that really can cause anxiety and depression in any and all of us.
Well, I agree with you. I think we've all found ourselves maybe in a position that thinking about going to a therapist would be a good idea. And there are some simple steps to think about getting started. I would first consider who your health insurance covers. I would also think about calling those people. So many therapists are full and cannot accept new patients, so I would call them. And then also visit their websites to make sure that it's compatible, because it's very important that your therapist and you are compatible. And sometimes you can find that out from their website and some of the personal information that they share.
Yeah, I think those are all great suggestions. If possible, I think it's worth having a 5 or 10 minute conversation with the therapist before you go. Make sure it's a good fit for both of you.
Agreed.
Because it's an investment of a huge amount of time and potentially money. A lot of times the insurance companies will require you to make a phone call yourself and not your provider. You can ask your provider for recommendations, who they would go to themselves, who they would send their family members to. Seems like a reasonable question. And then also, you know, your insurance company may limit your choices to be able to afford those things. So these are all really complex issues. But the single greatest thing is to start, to ask for help, to recognize you need some help. And our prayers are with you. Our thoughts are with you during what sounds like a difficult time. We hope that you get some help with a good therapist. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm a 33-year-old former competitive athlete who has chronic shoulder pain. Recently, my shoulder came completely out of its socket and the pain was intense. Though I was able to get it back in place and went to urgent care, I'm still having shooting pains down my arm. The urgent care nurse said I might be looking at surgery. Any thoughts?
Well, Leah, I know you've had some falls potentially in your marathon mountain biking. Have you ever hurt your shoulder?
I have. I've actually had a surgery on my shoulders about 5 years ago.
Did you dislocate your shoulder when you fell?
I separated my shoulder and tore the labrum, so I did have surgery.
So this particular listener's problems, you're like kind of personal. You're like, that could be me.
And I would consider seeing an orthopedic for sure. I think that your first step to resolving this problem, and it certainly can be resolved in other ways other than surgery. The physical therapy has come a long way. You want to check that out with the orthopedic. And if surgery is something that is called for, then proceed with somebody in with those expertise.
Yeah, I think those are great practical suggestions. It sounds like in this case that someone might have had a shoulder separation that kind of popped out and went back in. But like you said, it could have torn something much more significant. There could be instability. There could be nerve entrapment. There could be swelling. There could be fluid. There's so many different things that could be going on. I think it's a great idea to see a specialist, orthopedist, sports medicine, someone who really does specialize in this area here. The sooner, the better. Get involved in physical therapy and see. I wouldn't necessarily rush into surgery on this particular case because it may not have any huge benefit there, but it might be needed and you might need some specialized x-rays too. Thanks so much for that great house call. What's our very next house call, Laura?
Our 2-year-old daughter is always on the go and has become prone to minor accidents. When she hurts herself, how do we decide whether it's time to go for an ER visit?
Leah, you have some kids. I've had kids. How do you think about when you had to think about bringing a child in to be seen? What sort of things go through your mind as a parent?
Well, you know, first you need to assess the injury or the illness and decide whether it is an immediate threat. Of course, if it is immediate threat, definitely go to your nearest emergency room. But we do have other options that are maybe less costly, such as urgent care could be another option.
Yeah, I know in our particular clinic, the University of North Carolina Family Medicine, we have lots of extended hours, and we have great nurses on the line to answer the calls and to ask the type of questions to see for an ankle sprain, is the child able to put weight on it? That tells you information more if they can't put any weight on it. If they cut themselves, is it still bleeding after pressure for 5 or 10 minutes to see whether or not the cut is deep enough there? Did they lose consciousness like a concussion with a young child, you probably would want them evaluated. So it's really about having access to a qualified health professional. That's what I think that our listener needs here. Perhaps a dedicated phone line where you can get through to a real person, not this is 911, call it, you know, go if it's an emergency, go there. Well, thank you very much, but I really want to just talk with someone. That's what I think increasingly we need as a healthcare system. So, Laura, what's our very last house call?
I'm a 20-year-old man. Recently, I saw a commercial for the Gardasil vaccine portraying a man who got cancer from HPV. As far as I can remember, no one has ever recommended I get the vaccine. Should I?
Well, what a great question. And we tend to focus on getting the HPV vaccine, oftentimes in the U.S., thinking about Gardasil vaccination for women. And we think about giving it to young women before they're sexually active to really eliminate what we believe is the causative agent of ultimately cervical cancer. And so we don't think about it in the men as much. I don't know, Leah, if it's, you've ever really come across it.
I don't believe I've ever thought about it as a vaccination for a male.
But yeah, but it's an important vaccination for male, and it's actually recommended for men to suggesting the 3-dose, similar for women, men age 11 to 12, and also those ages 13 to 21 who've never had it. And the reason is it certainly, just as in women, it cuts down on venereal warts that can cause cancer. We can cause cancer in men, and it can cause also anal cancer. Now, the argument against it is that these are not as frequent diseases in men as they are in women. And if we just treat the women, well, the men aren't going to get it. But we also have males having intercourse with men. And so we have to cut down on all forms of transmission. And we also know that quality of life is increased when men do not have these diseases. So it is cost effective in men, even though it may be less cost effective than in women. And I do think it's something that at least I recommend, and I would imagine, Aaliyah, that potentially having had it discussed as a parent, you might say that's something that you might consider for if you had children in that age range.
Yes, I would definitely consider it for my son if he were in that age group.
Yeah, I would say talk with your doctor. These are reasonable things. Well, I will conclude that our house calls today, and we really want to thank you all for spending time and listening to your health and. We hope we presented information that's important to you and your health. You can share your questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu and follow us on Facebook, Twitter. You can go to our website at yourhealthradio.org. You can come to us for a free download. We want to thank UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, the UNC Department of Family Medicine. We want to thank our great guest today, Dr. Jonathan Oberlander. I want to thank my co-host, Dr. Leah Ranney. And on behalf of your health, we hope you'll join us again this time next week. Thank you very much.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.